Thundergrunt.
Hey guys,
Bob,
we're going to introduce ourselves, but first we are Writers Blockbusters. We're the show that treats the final edit of Hollywood movies like it's the script.
Yes.
And you guys introduce yourselves.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and full-time script consultant. And my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
I am at Jamie_Nash. That's my name. And my Twitter handle is Jamie Nash. And I'm a screenwriter. And buy my book, Nomad, now on Amazon Prime. I don't know.
Do that.
Yeah.
Goodbye. I'm Bob Rose. My Twitter handle is at Thundergrunt Bob. And I ate tacos last night. Anyway,
were they good?
Yeah, they were very good.
Nice
tacos right now.
They were like They were like artisan tacos. So yeah, we're going to talk about a certified classic masterpiece, whatever. Or Terminator 2, Judgment Day.
Is everyone here at the table big fans of this movie?
Yes.
I mean, it's like,
how can you not be?
This is just, this is gravy here, man.
I like the Axl Rose video. Guns N' Roses. But not the movie as much, but no.
I actually hate this movie. I love Terminator Genesis.
I like the 3D ride at Universal
Studios.
Yes,
ride was all right. It's so good. I love it.
I like that snobby lady that comes out in the beginning.
Yeah.
Hello.
I mean, the 3D ride is the extension of this movie.
Yeah. Yes.
If there is one.
It was kind of impressive.
Yeah, back in the day.
Oh, man, when I experienced it, I was a kid, so.
Terminator 2, 3D The Ride, right?
Yeah.
Well, we don't need to answer this question. We're going to ask it anyway. Jamie, who wrote it?
Well, here's the weird thing about it. James Cameron wrote it, but there was another guy who wrote it, too.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
William Wisher.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that name sounds very familiar.
Someone that most people don't know about, who got additional dialogue credit on The Terminator.
Yeah.
A weird credit.
It is a weird credit. But it's nice that they gave it to him.
Yeah. It makes it, I don't know if that's a real credit, a WGA credit.
In the book, they talk about.
Oh, really?
The process.
Okay.
The book of the film.
The book of the
Terminator 2, the book of the film.
The book of the film.
And then after Terminator 2, he also wrote Terminator 2, the arcade game. No. Judge Dredd screenplay, 1995.
Wow.
That's a movie I still like. I'm sorry, everybody.
The 13th Warrior in 2004.
I like that movie.
We're sitting in a house with a 13th Warrior poster hanging
on
the
wall.
Yes.
And you didn't even know that it was.
I didn't know that was that guy.
Co-wrote Terminator 2.
Right.
The excerpt. That's why his name sounded familiar. You read it
because I'm seeing it all the time.
You're looking at it.
Yeah.
The Exorcist, both Exorcist movies that were made from the same story, Exorcist the Beginning and Dominion, prequel to The Exorcist.
Right.
And then Terminator the Second TV movie. What the hell is that?
I don't know.
What?
That 2011.
I got to check that out. And then something called.
Is it spelled out the second?
It's spelled out the second. Terminator
the second. Okay.
And it says TV movie earlier screenplay. Oh, here it is. Terminator the Second is a parody of the film Terminator 2 Judgment Day, constructed solely of lines and phrases from the plays of William Shakespeare.
Weird.
All right.
Wow.
All right.
Next week on Writer's Blockbuster.
Terminator the Second.
You know what I wanted to ask you? Because maybe you know I don't, and the book didn't go into this. Gail Ann Hurd was the co-writer on Terminator, and she's one of the producers of this one. Do you know if she had any involvement in the story of this one? Because it feels like someone who had such a big influence on the first one would and is the producer of the second one would involve.
I spent like 3 hours reading about Terminator 2 for some reason. I don't think I needed to because I knew most of it, but I didn't see anything.
See any
it.
Of that? Okay. I just wanted to know because Sarah Connor, I mean, it feels like you know, yeah, she's one of the best female characters ever. It stands to reason that maybe the female writer who helped create her had something to do with this story,
I think James Cameron was dating William Wisher at the... No, I don't know. He punted and went for William Wisher.
Well, he was dating Catherine Bigelow at the time, though, I think.
Probably.
When was the maybe Linda Hamilton relationship? When were they married?
I don't know.
James Cameron.
I don't know.
I think that came after this.
Oh, man. She said my favorite line of all time from anyone ever. They's like, what went wrong with James Cameron? She said, I had to divorce him because he'd rather fuck the ocean than me.
That's so good.
Linda Hamilton.
Well, how much did it make? Because
in
1992, right?
It was the 91. And it was the number one movie of that year.
Obviously. A true blockbuster.
Right, yes. Yeah,
and it made $205 million domestically.
Wow.
And then $315 million internationally.
And that is in 91.
Wow.
And it was...
That's
the
nuts.
Thing, people... It's kind of the same story with James Cameron with every movie in that... It was over budget. It cost too much. It was long. They said, this movie will never make any money. Look at Terminator 1. And then it was the number one movie.
Right.
Same thing at Titanic. The Abyss is the only misfire, I guess he has on that. In that realm.
I love The Abyss.
Yeah, I do too.
Right. Yeah, of course.
But it's, The Abyss, they were right.
He has a knack.
Avatar as well. We'll see about Avatar 4, 5, 6, and 7.
Yeah.
I have my
Avatar
doubts.
17.
I mean, like, I think at this point, I just want to see what the hell he's doing.
Yeah, what's he up to?
Just come on, show us. You know. Anyway, introducing and setting up characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, this movie. So one of the things that if you pop this DVD in, the Blu-ray, and you're watching it,
Okay, good.
If you pop it in. Wow, it's like popping in.
the microphone is popping.
I just adjusted Jamie's microphone. Sorry.
The beginning of this movie has this really cool thing that it does where each scene introduces almost the next character. There's this whole, I don't know what to call it, the flash forward or whatever you want to call it, the dream fantasy sequence. And that kind of introduces the Terminators. And then the Terminators show up. And like the one is looking up John Connor on the computer and it gives this exposition about John Connor. You can see he has some criminal background and stuff like that. And then that throws to John Connor. And then you see a little bit of John Connor and they give you a great show, not tell exposition of him like fixing motorcycles and stuff.
Right.
And
also stakes.
And stakes.
It shows us the world they could be, right? Yeah.
They sort of get their own mini movies at the beginning.
Right. Yeah,
even Arnold gets his own little mini movie.
He does.
The T-1000 gets his own mini movie. It's like, here are the main players. Even Miles Dyson gets his own little mini movie.
Yeah, even Miles Dyson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and they keep throwing, like, so John then says, that's not my mother in the scene with the step-parents. And then it cuts to his mother.
Yeah.
And then she's, of course, you know, doing pull-ups and shit.
You
know, getting and you
still
know,
preparing
for the end of the world.
Yeah.
And we get a great there's a lot of in this movie to introduce characters, there's a lot of talking about characters.
Yeah.
That a third party is a common technique.
A lot of praise of the killer in this one too.
I didn't even write it down. It's too much.
There's so much.
There's a lot of where a third party will talk about someone and give you exposition. So whether it's that cop computer telling you about John Connor, or whether it's the doctor in the mental institution saying she's delusional,
it's humorous because we know he's wrong.
Right.
So he's saying all this
he's an idiot.
I wanted to revisit, so we haven't talked about this in a long time. Scott Myers go into the story. He's like sort of the official blog for the Blacklist. I don't know if listeners out there have ever read it. Some great stuff on there. And he has an exposition techniques course, which I haven't taken, but he's got some great blog posts that are sort of indicative of what you'd learn. And we talked about this on the Matrix episode. He says, use fascination, mystery, revelation, and conflict and humor to transform dull information into compelling, entertaining scenes. And this movie is like an hour of exposition. Almost
it's
every scene,
thick with it.
Every single scene, it's almost like the Doctor Sleep in that like the first half of the movie is almost all set up. And I wanted to go into some of the scenes.
The second half is almost all action.
It's
too.
All pay. Yeah.
It's all pay. Right.
There's all of those techniques that he just mentioned. They're sort of used. The the first one right from the start, Sarah's voiceover. She says, two Terminators were sent back in time to find John. The question is, well, who's going to find him first? So we have a mystery. Bam, right from the start. T-1000, like you said, you mentioned that great search, right? So there's mystery. What's he searching for? Right. And then there's revelation. Oh, shit, John Connor. And John Connor, we learn he's like, he's a criminal. He's got a criminal background. He's got foster parents. It's such a clever.
Completely the opposite of what we'd expect from the great hero he's going to see.
Absolutely.
We just saw the hero we saw.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're right. Yeah, yeah. We saw him as a badass.
He's been defined as like, yeah, like almost a cliched futuristic warrior. Right. Right. Yeah.
And here now we are learning, no, he's not like
he's
that.
He's a deadbeat criminal kid. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And then, we get humor to clarify John's foster parents are. He says, "Your foster parents are kind of dicks, huh?" Like, so we laugh, but that's exposition, right?
Right, right,
it's like
right,
a
right,
joke,
right.
But it's true. And then what
that's
we were just
a common sitcom technique is make your exposition a joke.
Oh,
that's
really?
What
I like
all
that.
The time.
Yeah,
oh,
that makes
good.
Sense.
That's good.
That's
always,
good.
Always turn your exposition into a joke.
And the next one is a joke, like we were saying. We're laughing at the doctor. He's like, basically. Like making fun of Sarah Connor
the whole
like
time,
everything we know about her to be true, and it's hilarious to us because we're like, oh my god, this is ridiculous. So there's humor again, and then this one I think is fascination when John uses the handmade thing to break into the ATM. It's like, what's he doing? Like, what is that? It's a fascination,
yeah.
And then he says, my mom taught me that, so bam. John's friend pulls out the picture of Sarah, and he's like, she's pretty cool, huh? And they're like, revelation, no, she's not cool at all. He thinks she's a psycho. Do you use exposition as ammunition? Do you use that technique? Have
what
you
does
heard
that
of
mean?
That technique?
I don't know
please,
that
please
okay. Describe that. Yes.
So exposition as ammunition, Hitchcock talks about this a lot, and I'm sure William Martell in his books gives plenty of examples of this. Mm-hmm. That's where a character is sort of using it in conflict to sort of get their way,
okay.
Whether it's to control the situation or to just assert dominance, or they sort of like they use exposition as a weapon.
Okay.
And a great example of exposition as ammunition is Sarah in the video when she's like growing and getting angrier and angrier and just starts like yelling at the doctor who doesn't believe her, and it works because it sort of feels like it's her weapon. You know, her knowledge is her weapon, but it's also like her plague.
It's also defining for the audience what's exactly going to happen,
right? But
because we know she's not crazy the entire time,
right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel like we're being.
I guess does that put us in a superior position of most of the characters?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's superior. Yeah.
Yeah.
The timeout stop the bike. There's like action in there. There's conflict. There's mystery. There's revelation. You're not here to kill me. So what are you here for? You know, it's another great. It's just like there's so much craft there. The Terminator is explaining that the T-1000 is different than him, and we're like fascinated, like, oh shit, like what's different about him?
Right.
You know, and there's just so many. I could just keep going, but I feel like that Scott Myers, those labels work really well.
Yeah.
They're like a great way to like kind of, if you have information that you want to give to the audience, use those things.
Yeah. And everybody does, and that's pretty much one of the hardest things to fix in some screenplays early on is the exposition side of it.
Oh my god, yeah. It's like you'll see a page of someone just talking and
it's kind of one of the
which there is
things.
In this movie, but it comes off so smooth
because of those things and
that's the one thing. If you have a lot of exposition in your scripts, it is one of those problems that you can just go in and tackle. You can just like take one of these techniques and say, I have this exposition, how do I make it more palatable, how it's not just somebody saying something we need to know. But how do we use these kind of techniques?
Or it'll be the opposite, where you won't get any of this. And shit's just happened, and you're like, I don't understand what's going on.
Like, which, it could be an artistic choice, but probably not.
Sometimes that's okay.
Sometimes
I'm actually okay
revealing,
with that.
Revealing the exposition
later. As far as reveals, the one thing I added to this was something we need to remember about this movie, which I'd say up there with like Empire Strikes Back as far as reveals goes. Like it's hard to remember when this was a shock that Arnold was actually the good guy and the new guy is actually the bad guy.
I don't even remember, like, I almost wonder if I read a spoiler before I saw it in the theater.
Really?
And I'm sure I saw it opening night, Friday night, because this was the height of me watching movies as a kid.
Yeah. Right, right, yeah.
And I'm sure I went and saw it. I remember I had Premiere Magazine, and I was all over the
Abyss.
I was that kid then, so I bet you it was spoiled for me. And so I can't even remember.
I don't think I saw this movie until like 95, you know, like years after, and I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And I remember actually watching it on VHS.
That's
and being
awesome.
Like, oh, I remember that moment when you realize that Arnold's the good guy.
I have no memory of ever not knowing it.
So. In the book of the film, Terminator 2, the book of the film, it's a great screenwriting book. They said, because I remember experiencing it like you, Bob.
Yeah, I remember
being like, oh my God, because I was 11 and I definitely saw this in the movies. And I remember having that Luke, I'm your father moment.
Right,
like,
right. Yeah. Which is not afforded to this movie anymore. I feel like it's not talked about anymore.
No. Well, so in the book, they said that James Cameron had written it to be impactful that way, but the marketing team decided to reveal that before.
I was
the movie
wondering
came
about
out.
The trailer.
That might have been why.
So yeah. I was all over trailers then and stuff.
Right, right.
They marketed the film
Mr. Trailer.
Honestly, as this is going to be an experience where you get to see Arnold be the good guy. And so
was Cameron pissed?
I don't know. It doesn't talk about that the fallout of that.
Yeah.
But it was crafted and shot.
There's so much construction and like nuance to the way it's put together before that reveal.
And it was the marketing decision.
That said, if you would have just asked me this cold, like how was it marketed, I would have said I think it gave it away in the marketing. That would have been my gut would have said that.
I was too young.
I just don't remember it ever being a surprise.
For me, the reason it was a surprise because I didn't have my fingers on the pulse. I didn't have like cinema and movie news was
thing. Yeah, I wouldn't have known back then. Yeah.
And I think it would have been hard to market this movie in some ways to cut the trailer without showing that. It would have. You know, I mean, you could.
I understand what you're saying.
I almost want to go back.
It's Arnold again.
Yeah.
Same movie.
And who's this other
guy?
Well,
back then it wasn't.
It'd
be like,
right.
You just have to say Arnold Schwarzenegger. Right.
That was the Twitter response I was giving.
Terminator 2 would have been enough.
I meant before this to go and look at the old trailers just out of curiosity.
I'm going to watch them after we're done.
Yeah.
I want to know.
Check it out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But like what I was going to. Yeah. But you basically already said it.
But by the way,
it's just so well crafted to hide those things and perfectly balanced.
It feels
you
like
couldn't know.
You're not supposed to know.
You couldn't know.
We skipped over this. We didn't have this, but this movie apparently the liquid metal, you know, stuff was actually written for the first movie, but he couldn't pull it off.
Yeah.
Whoa.
And I think a lot of what was in the second movie was actually written into the first
movie. The whiteboard,
movie,
which we'll get to later.
There's a whiteboard.
Oh, for the first.
That's why the whiteboard's so good.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. That's a big thing.
This is leftover whiteboard. This is Lost Ark. I mean, this is Temple of Doom. All
Temple
the shit that didn't show up in Raiders.
On that note, too, Jamie, like, or this is kind of to me like a Jurassic Park situation where, like, back in the day, you feel like the big boom with like Jurassic Park or this movie was like, oh my God, the effects. But when it comes down to it, then you go back and you look at these movies, it's like, it's not actually just the fact that the effects are awesome. This is an amazing movie. It's the movie.
Yeah.
It's not like the T-1000 is incredible, but that's not why this is
even
great.
Even as a crazy movie geek as a kid, I wasn't like, I didn't look at this movie and say it was the effects. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
They didn't even make that much of an impression on me. Yeah, I was probably like, that's really cool.
I remember the kid at school, though, talking about like the T-1000. I remember that specifically.
I was probably like, that's really cool what they could do with the liquid metal, but it's also really cool when they have that canal chase, you know, and that's amazing.
Arnold shooting that gun.
Right.
That's cool. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, I just wanted to bring that up.
It's a great point.
It's never brought up, and I feel like he was very deliberate with it.
Absolutely.
And that sucks at the marketing.
Because I do think it could have that if it hadn't been, if they had kept it a secret, it could have been that Luke, I am your father level of, oh, holy shit.
Right.
I felt it for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So I guess we talked about exposition
techniques.
Yeah,
I want to talk about transitions.
Oh,
did we skip? Oh,
we're skipping around. That's okay.
That's okay.
Transitions. Go ahead.
So, We talked about this in the Monster Squad episode. The scripts I'm given as a consultant, the amateur scripts I'm given, maybe one of the top five notes I give is your transition needs work. Your transitions are uncinematic because the early writers, and I was guilty of this myself, and I think you, Jamie, you said that you were late to this in the craft, right?
For sure. I think it's one of the later things.
It's like one of the later things, but it's sort of the sign of like a professional, like
or just somebody that has the gift.
Right. Mm-hmm. I didn't learn it until we started making feature films off of the scripts we were writing, my partner and I, Chris LaMartina, and so I would write things and we would go to shoot it and he'd be like, I don't know what I'm going to cut to. Right. Like, this is very like, what are we supposed to do here?
It's also
like, oh shit. Like I needed to write a transition. Mm-hmm.
It's also not just what to cut to. It's also your scene has to have an ending.
A smooth
right
shift from one
to another
scene to the next that's like really feels cohesive. Mm-hmm. And
you can't have somebody end a sentence and it cuts to somebody in another room saying a sentence.
And I feel like right. You said as an editor you've experienced this
lack
of
I've edited for other people where they're like they shot a scene and then it literally did what I just said. It would like a character would say a sentence and it would just end. But it wouldn't feel like the end of a scene. It would just be the end of a conversation. And then like the next scene is somebody in another room having another conversation. And it's a hard cut to them just talking.
Star wipe is the answer.
but they didn't film enough, so you couldn't like do a transition effect. Like I know it's not writing, but you couldn't even pop on a transition.
Well, so,
you know?
And so the standard thing and what a lot of people think, and I'm sure there's people listening like, I don't think that.
Yeah. How dare you,
but
Jimmy?
But guess what? I would say 9 out of 10 writers that I see who are just learning the craft do think this or do this where they'll just be like, I'm just going to put in a cut to, I'm just going to put in a dissolve to, I'm just going to put in a fade to, I'm just going to put in a wipe. It's not considered like part of the craft and like the standard thing that you need in your
scenes.
It's not talked about.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of techniques, and like one of these days I'm going to build a master list and like we could do an Edgar Wright episode. And we'll just do the transitions of Edgar Wright. Oh my God! I mean, I could like just spout out a big long list right now of his. But this one has—I didn't think of this as a movie with great transitions. And then when we were sort of looking for things to talk about, I was like, "Oh man, I love the transitions in this movie."
They're
I wasn't
really
ready.
Good.
So this one, one is before and after, and naked Arnold stands over the biker, and then cut to fully clothed Arnold. Walks out and he's bad to the bone.
Right, bad to the bone.
And it's also comedic, right? Mm-hmm. Like we're laughing.
Which I think started the bad to the bone trope, didn't it?
We saw it a lot after.
yeah.
Night to Day is a very easy one, like similar or Day to Night, Night to mm-hmm. Day. This one has some of those. Nighttime, T-1000 reads the police computer and it says what John's address is, and then cuts to the daytime and we're at John's address.
Right.
There's a comic question and answer you described. She's not my mother, Todd. Cut to, who is your mother? Sarah Connor.
Sarah Connor.
There's another question and answer that's like one of my favorite transitions of the whole movie is where Sarah's saying she's lying and saying she no longer believes that about the Terminator that it existed. And he's like, you don't believe anymore that the company covered it up? And she said, why would they? Cut to Cybernon Systems and a model of the chip on the screen.
On the screen.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Visual confirmation, and this is almost like a pun, where he says, your foster parents are dead, and it cuts to like the foster mom with the blade and the...
Right, the blade in the head.
Fucking transition technique. Opposites. The security guard locks the front doors of the psychiatric facility, and we cut to Sarah picking the lock of her room. So you have the same scenario shown different ways, and it's very smooth. Another awesome night today is when he's standing at the garage and he's looking out, we see the sun set and go back up.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
He hasn't moved an inch. Like, he's literally, it's like
a gas station.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Would you call that a match?
Match cut?
Yeah.
It's a match dissolve.
Match dissolve.
It's a match dissolve.
Okay.
I don't honestly know how they did that shot.
Yeah,
every time I watch, I like the CGI effects, I'm always like, I get it, but that shot, I'm always like, did they have Arnold stand there in the exact same position and then have him leave and then come back and they like lined him up again or something? I don't know.
Maybe they just had a outside some giant
it might
black
have been.
Cloth.
It might have been
and
fake
they just
light
went down,
or it might have been fake light.
It might have been one
light.
Shot
yeah.
like that was actually the
right.
same shot. the and then a visual pun which. are my movies are filled with them. John says to Miles, come on, let's book. And it cuts to a group of masked police running full speed.
Right.
So it was just, it was an element of it that I hadn't noticed before. And it's just like a great thing. It's a great thing to do in your movie.
That's why the movie does speed along too.
It does.
It really speeds along.
It's snappy. Mm.
Yeah.
No, I think it helps when in screenplays when you put those transitions in, it speeds it along as well.
It feels like you're in the hands of somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah. Every scene just leads to the next.
Like, all right.
Well, that goes with that because one of the things I put in here, I want to talk about audience surrogates, which I thought was cool because I kind of didn't think about this ever, and I've seen this movie how many times, you know? John is the audience surrogate for, like, if you're just coming to this movie alone without knowing what the Terminator is, he's like the total audience surrogate for this movie.
You're right.
He gets all the exposition thrown at him. He's the reason that we know what's going on, whereas Sarah is for people that are from the other movie. If you're a fan of Terminator, you'd only need to see her story and you'd be fine.
And for a lot of us, we were experiencing this as kids.
Right,
so he's like the easy connector.
He's the easy connector.
And they probably didn't see Terminator 1 because they were like five. Right,
I did.
Yeah.
Like, I saw T2 first.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's why it works so
that's
well.
Really
it's
smart.
Like, it's very constructed. Like,
so he's
he knew
learning
the audience.
It's sort of like he's learning as the younger audience.
As the younger audience learning.
Yeah.
Who probably didn't see the slasher movie. Called the Terminator.
And do you think that they chose the comedic tone because they had a kid in there? You think that was like kids might be brought to this because we have a kid lead?
I think it just comes with that.
Okay.
There's
it's
no
just
reason
naturally.
There's no reason that that character shouldn't have a slight bent of levity to it, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a good call. Since he's a kid,
right.
Yeah, we're gonna.
Right. And also, there's something that's never discussed, I think, in this movie is there's a bit of a buddy cop comedy to it.
Mm-hmm.
Where one guy's the funny guy, one guy's the dry guy. Right. It's a dragnet thing almost, like a little Men in Black type of deal. Mm-hmm. It's not.
I never really thought of it.
It's
like
not
that.
Totally
that's
there, but I mean, yeah. One guy is what is his name?
The straight man.
Straight man. Yeah. Right. Arnold's the straight man in this movie.
Yeah, that's.
You could almost look at Arnold with a comic blind obsession. You know, he has. I don't know what it would be exactly, but it's the roboticness or the literalness of his mission and
blind
like
obsession
that.
Sticking to being a
his
machine
programming,
and not.
His programming is his blind obsession.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
That's really.
What
good.
Is a blind obsession? So, we're just saying
it's a Robert. Okay, so in Robert McKee's comedy seminar, and he didn't invent this, but he's the one that I learned it from. He thinks that in all comedies, the root of it comes from the characters having like something that they are obsessed over that they typically don't even know that it's like something that's they're obsessed over. And you can make all the jokes around this one thing, and that's a good one, Jamie. Mm-hmm. He's obsessed with his mission.
He's obsessed with his mission, which is just that. That's all he has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
well, we'll get to that in a second.
That's good.
Because I wanted to kind of talk about his arc, if there is one.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Sarah Connor first, because there's plenty to talk about with her, right?
Yeah, yes. for sure.
So
the character makeup. Let's talk about
that. So first I want to say go read this book. It's free. It is on – have you ever been to Bang to Write? It's with a letter
sounds
two.
Sounds like a porn site.
It's not at all. Not. It's like the polar opposite. It's bang number two.
Good
right.
Way to get rid of writer's block.
I believe this book is free.
Bang two wrong.
It's it's called How. It's by Lucy Hay. How Not to Write Female Characters. Huh. And
this would be helpful for a lot of people.
Yes,
me included, probably.
Oh my God, I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
She says. Her like main point is, you know, we always it's the strong female characters. She like tries to motivate people to get away from that and say it's not strong, it's complex.
Yeah.
And I feel like Sarah Connor is a perfect example of complex, not strong. It's like most people are like, well, she's got muscles and she's doing this. Like we meet her, she's doing the pull-ups, but it's not. That's not why she's awesome.
No, she's a bottle of anxiety, fear, hatred, love. Even you know what I mean. She's got
her wheel, her character
is
what
everywhere.
What would you call that? Her where you say all the facets of who she is. It's so rich.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen the character wheel for Walter White, and there's like there's like 50 things on it, facets of his personality.
No, she's got all of it, man.
She's, yeah.
Yeah.
It's,
like, her whole mission in this movie is, number one, it's like to warn people, but also like to save her son, but also to run from the demons that she's after her. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, everything is happening at once to this woman.
Mm-hmm. It's insane.
It is not a simple part. It is not at all.
No, not at all. I went and I kind of went down and kind of showed how we, all the different ways we learn about her. And I'll just go through a little bit. And, cause most people will just be like, she's smart. And that's such a bland way to like set yourself in a trap. But smart, yeah. There's many ways to like show smart and to like make it more specific than
resourceful.
Smart. Right. So like
confident.
Like in the video, she suffers emotional pain from we see her breakdown. She's plagued by guilt that she can't protect her son because she's in prison. She's haunted by the judgment day knowledge and she feels pressure and responsibility to save the world. She has undeserved misfortune because she knows the truth and everybody else thinks she's crazy.
I was going to say the term someone I've heard is like man without a country.
Yes.
Like, you know, she's alone in this.
She's completely alone. And she's alone in the whole world.
And, right. And what makes it so effective is that she's alone in this, but we're with her.
We're with her.
The audience is with
it's
her.
So, right? It's so such good. A strong rooting. So it's these rooting influencers. Right. She's manipulative. She lies to the doctor to get permission to see John. She's maternal. She shows she's going to sacrifice anything, including herself, to save John.
Right.
She's cunning. When the police show up and show her pictures of the new Terminator, she steals a paperclip. She's, like you said, she's resourceful. She uses the paperclip to break out. She's merciless. She beats the guard, and she beats anyone who comes in her way. She's funny. He says, "You broke my arm." There are 215 bones in the human body. That's one. She's funny, man.
206, but go ahead.
Did I miss the...
It's either 209 or 206.
It doesn't matter.
I remember this line being a factual inaccuracy.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, that line's a
James
factual
Cameron, goddammit.
Right, yeah.
She's creative. She fills a syringe with liquid plumber and uses it as a weapon.
Right.
She's like, decisive. She's, like, out of the car, and she shoots at him. She doesn't even think. She's skilled with weapons. She has no compassion. She's like, "You shouldn't have come for me. You're too important." She doesn't care about herself. She's, like, completely selfless. She's prepared. She stockpiled weapons in a desert locker.
She's conflicted.
She's conflicted.
I love that. One of my favorite aspects of her character is her, the way that, well, it's, I don't know if it's more of a performance thing than a script thing, but her conflict in dealing with Arnold not being evil is my
Man.
Just, I mean, that's more maybe a Linda Hamilton's performance.
Yeah.
But it's got to be on the page somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like, I love that. I didn't think about this one when I was heading into it, but like it's the performance aspect. I don't think it's on the page. He keeps looking at her every single time she asks him a question, like, "What are you doing? Like, what are you trying to, you've got something, you're working out something." And he almost seems like he doesn't want to answer anything she's asking.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like, "Keep talking." Like she actually has to like pressure him into like,
well,
telling him things.
Does she count as, we've talked about on this show a lot, a half man?
Absolutely.
Yeah. She counts as a half.
I think so.
So a half man is somebody who has faced the threat before.
Yeah, she is the half man.
Well,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, and half men are usually in Monster in the House, but she functions the same way.
I mean, Terminator is a monster
in
movie.
The House.
True.
Yeah.
The first movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, exactly.
I mean, she's broken. She knows everything. She's, you know, she looks at Arnold as with disbelief.
She's the one who gives all the praise of the killer speeches.
She gives she gives so many that eventually she's just praising him.
Yeah.
The praise is the killer speech. Unlike most movies, maybe ever, when she gives that one about how he's the perfect father.
Yeah.
What, like in a movie where that's, we've watched her completely be in utter terror over this character.
Yeah.
Strangely enough, I can see Arnold serving as kind of a half man as well.
Yeah.
Like yeah.
He has knowledge of the beast and how to beat
and
it.
And Judgment Day, Skynet.
But, Jamie, I think what's interesting here is like Linda Hamilton's the half man of Arnold, and Arnold's the half man of the T-1000. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like
sure.
He knows what
for
the T-1000 is capable of.
Right.
And even he can't express the emotion, but he's like, yes, he's more advanced than me. Mm-hmm. I will lose.
Yeah,
you know, like he knows.
That's, yeah, there. That
he
fateful,
knows.
He's he knows he's not gonna win.
Right, and the only reason he runs into everything without fear is because he is a robot.
Right,
right. Yeah, but he's fully aware of the stakes.
One other thing in the writing of this, I think I heard that Linda Hamilton was the one that suggested that they take into account how she would be after the events of the first movie. Like, that wasn't necessarily James Cameron's idea. That was more Linda Hamilton's
idea. After what I've read about her and how she approached Dark Fate, it makes perfect sense because she seems very, very in control of how she wants to be portrayed on screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's awesome.
It made me think of Speed and Speed 2 and the difference in how Sandra Bullock's character has not...
We did an episode on that.
Her life has not changed one bit from the experience, and who she is as a character has not like expanded upon the events or prepared for more situations like that. It's sort of like betrayed like what we saw for the character in the first one, and I'm so glad this one like does honor.
And I feel like this is the movie that people bring up with stuff like when I feel like this was brought up a lot with Halloween 2018.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I heard about like literally Sarah Connor being brought up.
Sure,
that makes sense.
We
brought it up.
We did. But I also
it
like
was probably Bob.
Yeah, guy might have been. I read stuff where people were like they made her a Sarah Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, Michael Myers is her Terminator, mm-hmm. made her, which mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense since Michael Myers is a slasher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she kind of became that trope.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right?
And it's sort of like everybody's the Sarah Connor. Yeah.
The hard-bitten,
like,
female, empowered female who's been through hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Sarah Connor's the
Furiosa.
Character. Right, exactly.
Yeah, is like the new breed.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. God, make a movie with those two if you're gonna mash up stuff.
Man.
It'd be so awesome. Yeah. But is there anything else we want to discuss with Sarah Connor?
The last one is just that ultimately she can't pull the trigger. She can't kill. She, when it comes down to it, she's morally sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like my favorite moment in the whole movie for her character is that when it comes down to it, she can't kill Miles Dyson.
Right. On a character we've seen literally take her insanity to the brink.
Yeah.
On all this, and she can't do it.
Yeah. Essentially,
because
in that,
she values human life.
Yeah. She values
essentially
human
in
life.
That section of the movie, she becomes the Terminator. You know, she.
Yeah.
Right. She's doing what the Terminator.
The premise folding in on itself.
Exactly.
What's great about it is we believe that she's totally as capable of this.
Absolutely. Right.
There's no doubt.
There's no doubt
in
she's
going
to kill Miles.
Right. Right.
That's why there's so much tension there. We're like, no.
Because there's nothing in the whole movie up until that moment to make you think that she's not going to kill somebody.
Right.
Especially the man responsible.
Yeah.
Of course she is.
Yeah.
And then she can't do it.
And honestly, we would understand if she did.
Right.
Yeah.
Other arcs. Does John Connor have an arc in this movie? Does the T-800?
The T-800 definitely does.
He definitely does.
John Connor.
It's a tiny, tiny one.
Yeah. Well,
I know why you cry.
Yeah, but
right.
at the same time, he's sacrificing himself in the end.
Yeah.
He's doing these stuff, and he's kind of doing it on his own. You know, whether or not he was.
Yeah, you can't go with this kind of logically. This is kind of
it's a dream logic thing.
The fact that he could even learn,
right?
But they ask him. They set.
They
it
do
up
say
and
he
they,
does
and
learn.
And
so
the whole thing is built. Yeah,
he's
and
a learning computer.
He.
So.
I think John Moore is almost like a Forrest Gump type character. Mm-hmm. Like he teaches people.
Right.
Like he changes the people around him rather than
him changing,
which is sort of like a preview of who his character will become. A man who changes everyone else.
That's a leadership quality.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He like preserves life. Like he is every scene is about him trying to keep people from getting hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And then like ultimately he like has to sacrifice because like Arnold has to do whatever he says,
mm-hmm.
so he could order Arnold not to go.
Well,
into
that's
the...
a good thing to talk about because at the very end he does try to, and Arnold doesn't listen.
Right,
that's the moment, the T-800's arc. The fact that he goes that he's like, no, the mission is more important than the protocol to listen to you.
Yeah, so
that's him actually learning,
and he learns
the value of life and the future.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, now it is a computer, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
As the audience, we experience it as actual growth, where he's like, it's like a Spock thing. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Yeah.
Right there, you know?
I mean, that's it. Yeah.
And tied to the theme, which is pretty clear, I wouldn't say heavy handed, but.
I mean, it's Disney-like.
It's Disney-like. It's
obvious. Yeah.
But it works.
It's stated obvious, but The overall theme for this movie, it's kind of, you know, do people even care enough to fix the apocalypse that's coming? It's a very modern theme. Right,
right.
And if even a robot could do it, maybe there is hope that one person could do something and change and go against their programming,
not,
so to speak.
It's not just any robot. It's the model of robot we saw as a vicious killer.
The ultimate human killer.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
Beforehand.
Learns to value human life. What a shift.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I grabbed the quote from James Cameron, and I had taken this quote to talk about the T-1000, but all, it ended up being a perfect way that he described the theme. This was when he was asked why he made the T-1000 a cop. It's kind of controversial.
Yeah.
But it talks about
the
theme.
You know what, Jimmy? I wasn't going to bring this up. Because I thought about bringing this up and putting it on here. I was like, do we talk about stuff like this? Go ahead.
We don't. Yeah.
We don't
we're
usually.
Not a woke podcast.
Well, I think that we're not unwoke.
We're not
just
unwoke.
Try
yeah.
to avoid controversy. Yeah. Don't go saying shit. That. We just don't talk about controversy. That's all. That's all.
That's better said than
yeah,
what I just
yeah,
said.
That's, yeah. Gosh. Come on. You're going to sound like we're like alt writers over here.
We should put that on the poster.
We're not,
we're not a woke podcast.
We'll get a whole new group of listeners.
Oh boy.
Please
sorry. No.
Failure.
No Breitbart fans, thank you.
No. He said give me the buzz like on Price is Right.
Right, right.
The Terminator films, James Cameron says, the Terminator films are not about the human race getting killed off by future machines. They're about losing touch with our humanity and becoming machines, which allows us to brutalize each other. Cops think all non-cops are less than they are. They dehumanize the people they are sworn to protect and desensitize themselves in order to do that. I know we have listeners who are police officers, and you're awesome.
Yes, we're not saying...
Not saying that. Just using it to explain the thematic
It's
choice.
Funny, because I wrote under, at the very bottom, I wrote James Cameron and his portrayal of authority. Which goes right with this, right? Yeah, it goes right with this. Yeah.
So I think that speaks to the theme that you were just saying.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
for sure.
Yeah.
It's a touchy thing to say.
It is a touchy thing
It's a touchy
to
thing
say.
To say.
But, right. you know, it's there. It's there.
Oh, it's definitely there.
Yeah.
Especially when you also have, like, you have the T-1000 is portrayed as a cop, and then the good guy looks like, you know, he's... like an agent of chaos.
Mm-hmm.
He looks like a biker. What's
right?
And in this case, I mean, while he may say that, the it would be like if somebody disguises themselves as a cop and goes on a murder rampage.
Right.
It's not the same as being
it's
a cop.
It's not the same as being a cop.
But
I think
but still,
understood it.
But
held...
still, he's using the guise of the cop to do all the dastardly deeds he needs
right.
to do.
Right.
It's
right.
easier for him with that guise.
And it's sort of a commentary on what police officers could get
I agree
away
with you, too. I just, yeah. you know.
Because you could spin it the opposite way where. The cop is the good guy. We're supposed to trust them, and he's doing the bad things.
Yeah,
right.
He's, even
bad.
More
he's
corrupting it. He's
right.
corrupting,
he's
the,
corrupting
good.
The good.
Yeah,
yes.
you're right. You're right.
That's a good call. Yeah.
If Jimmy C wants to say it that
Jimmy
way.
C, that's
Jimmy
what
C.
That's
Jimmy
C.
Him.
JC. Call him JC.
Jimmy Cam.
okay.
Jimmy Cam.
Jimmy Cam.
That's his new name.
I think there's two characters we should talk about when it comes to whiteboard material.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's obviously the two robots. Because the things that they do that he does with both robots in this movie, there's just whiteboard galore.
I feel like we haven't discussed the
what,
concept
of whiteboard.
The
yeah. What?
Go ahead, Jamie. Yeah.
Jamie, give us that.
It's really related to this promise of the premise thing. So we talk about the promise of the premise sometimes. And in the Blake Snyder books, the promise of the premise also usually lands in that fun and games section, the early act two. It also spreads throughout the movie. But in particular, that section usually shows a lot of the promise of the premise. So whatever your movie conceptually is, it's delivering all these great, clever ideas that just milk that idea for every ounce of juice they
have. You said it on whatever episode, Jamie. You were like, it's the reason we go to the movie.
It's the reason.
Like, you go to this movie to see the stuff they're going to do with the robots.
Yes.
And everything else is kind of like the cream on top of that, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Killer robots
from the future.
And you want to squeeze... Yeah. All the juice out of that.
Out of that thing.
Now, the first movie, of course, he squeezed the juice. This is the problem with sequels. He squeezed the juice out of Arnold being the Terminator.
So the whiteboard is different for...
So you got to come up with a new
but
whiteboard.
You said that this is... He wanted to do it.
He wanted to do the liquid metal robot.
That explains so much. That this is like he had a whiteboard for all this stuff
already. He
already
had the ideas down.
And he was like, damn, like I wish I could get those into the movie somehow.
So all of that stuff, like going through the bars, or that great scene where it reverses like the angle from the fight.
Yes.
You know? Or something that can get shot and heal from its own bullets.
What
are all the ways you can explore the liquid
turn into
metal.
Sword hands.
A character that can drip through a hole in the ceiling.
All the impersonations.
Right.
We see him getting frozen.
We see him as part of the floor.
We see
Arnold shoot a piece of him off, because you're like, what happens if this piece of liquid gets separated from itself? You know,
yeah, what does that look like?
We get to see it, and then we get to see it again
in even more extreme, different ways.
How do you kill this unkillable beast? I don't know. One scene. I love the extended edition of this movie.
Me too.
Yeah, I think it's a better movie.
Me too.
And the theatrical edition is already great, but I don't know which one you guys watched
I watched the regular version.
But
one of
my favorite parts of the extended edition is that after he gets completely melted and shattered and reforms, is that it shows the T-1000 glitching. Which I was like, I miss that whenever I watch the theatrical.
The pain, instead of it being so strong and overpowering.
Yeah. I just like the idea of it, like, here's this unkillable thing that it's not.
Right.
Immortal. It Losing can
power.
Be killed. Yeah. It can be. It has defects.
That's good.
Right. Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. I'm glad they added. He added it back in later.
So the idea of the whiteboard is kind of just writing, like, before you start screenwriting, or you have your log line and you have this great idea, like a liquid metal robot, and you just basically fill a whiteboard with cool ideas that can kind of be your ammunition as you go through writing the screenplay, and you can put those pieces inside of it. And in this case, we had the liquid metal, but we also have the Terminator, who was used in the first movie, but now I would imagine as a good guy, like that's what I would whiteboard.
Can the Terminator smile?
Well, there's those things.
There's
too.
That. Yeah, right.
Yeah, and even, and then his programming. And
it's
not
the Pinocchio
being
stuff. Yeah.
Right. What if you ordered him not to kill? How would he react?
All the ways that he's going to get them out of the situations without killing everybody. That was something I noticed this time, big time. Like, wow, he really
Shoots
goes to
knees.
Great lengths in every scene. It was sort of this tension that I didn't have in my memory. That, oh, shit, like, that's right. He can't kill anybody. Like,
but the genius is that he interprets not killing as beating someone within an inch of their life.
Right.
Like, you know what, John, like, I always, like, when I watch this movie now, I'm like, John should have clarified how much damage he should do to people.
Hang on. Don't just hurt them a little.
Yeah, like don't, even if you can just, like, just incapacitate them, don't, like, throw them against through a door. There is a few times where I'm like, okay, that person died. Like, he totally killed that guy. He threw him through a window.
Yeah, I think that guy's going to die.
That guy's
going
to die, probably.
I'll give, to bounce off your whiteboard, I'll give the bad example. So, a lot of people don't milk their ideas, and they don't do the whiteboarding phase to kind of give us as much exploration of that singular idea of the premise. And so what I see and what I get scripts all the time, I will get sort of the T-1000 that just uses his finger to kill everybody.
Yeah.
And every single scene, he won't be doing anything else except for putting his finger in the people's eyes. It'll be like 90 pages, and that is the lone thing that he
does. It's like Jason just chopping someone's head off every time.
Right, but that is a result of, like, not doing that whiteboard, not trying to see all the interesting ways you could take that idea and do cool stuff that we've never seen before, and just show us every possible way that you could, like, do something cool with it.
James Cameron obviously had this stuff down, because I always think, and I love it, wouldn't change it for the world, but that moment when the T-1000 literally turns around with inside of his own body. That's a whiteboard thing. Yeah, like, what if the guy could literally just go inside of himself and come out the other
end?
And
how am I going to organically plop that into the story somewhere? But you got it at the board. Because a lot of people, and I am all about trying to help people get into the flow and just, like, write as much as possible. But, like, a lot of people sort of, like, they get so excited about their idea for a movie, they just start writing the movie. Mm-hmm. And sort of the danger of that is you get it so unrepairable, right? You've sort of painted yourself into a corner by not doing the whiteboarding first, that, like, if you come up with ideas after the fact, you're like, it doesn't work. It's like, shit.
Also, is it part of whiteboarding, like, the limitations of something?
Like, what do you mean?
Like,
what
like, mean? not only is like the awesome stuff that like the T-1000 does, but we need like Arnold gives his praise of the killer speech and says the things like, you know, the idea that he can't make complex machines. I think that's that's a whiteboard thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, because that answers something for the audience.
Yeah,
and it also
the makeup of the villain. Absolutely.
It also sets
up
why he's going to do all this other stuff, right?
I think the key thing with whiteboard stuff, too, is Hollywood really wants, like, when you're trying to sell your screenplays or you're trying to get jobs in television shows, what they really want from screenwriters are idea people.
Mm-hmm.
They want people that can bring the ideas. So if you're that person that can sit down and you're at a meeting and they're like, we're thinking about, you know, making this movie, and you're just filled with ideas and you're firing them at will, that's the type of person they're really looking for. They're looking for people that do things that they don't do automatically. So I think showing that in your screenplays is really key to getting hired or getting gigs and things like that. You want to be somebody that kills it.
It makes your screenplay seem so much more clever.
Oh, absolutely. Clever.
Even if like the whole overarching thing isn't as clever, the small things will make it
clever. Clever is the magic word in the screenwriting.
Yeah.
Clever is the thing that people want to find clever people.
If you can come up with a moment where a T-1000 melts through the door and then the gun gets stuck, that's like so intensely clever and imaginative.
And you can imagine that in a writer's room, like there will be plenty of people that know how to save the cat and do other things.
Yeah.
But how many people just come up with that stuff and it's like gold and you're just like, I'm dropping that in.
Yeah.
So when you're trying to get a TV gig or something, that's exactly the kind of people you want.
It's like all in this movie, a lot of that stuff too is like in the choreography. You know what I mean? With the T-1000. Like, you know, with the gun where he shoves the gun in him and then he reforms the gun into his.
Yeah.
So he's holding it with his hands, not his torso anymore. That's like, that's so clever.
Yeah, it's really clever.
Well, yeah.
It's all
like, even if the movie wasn't written perfectly, it still would be watchable because it's awesome.
Well, it's like, and it's sort of like, this is another example of a movie where you could sort of take any part of the movie and make a trailer out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's what you're looking for, the trailer moments, like Jamie said.
Yeah, for sure.
The last thing we got on the agenda is sub goals, shifting goals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought that's an interesting thing because
Sarah Connor,
John Connor, and the T-800 all have kind of, they're all in the same team, but all have kind of a split mission, don't they?
Yeah.
This movie's different. That's how it really differentiates itself from the first movie.
Yeah.
Is the first movie's just a survival movie. You know, there's really not there's a bigger picture in that if she survives, the world survives.
Right.
But it really is just survival. And that's it. Like, if we live, we're okay.
We're okay.
This movie has this bigger destroy the Death Star kind of mission with the survival mission as well. And it keeps, and that's where it keeps shifting. Because, you know, the Terminator is there to protect John, but the John forces it to break Mom out. He's trying to protect her.
Yeah.
And then
T-800 is protecting him. And the world, too?
And the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Mom decides to turn it into a mission about Dyson
and
solve that problem and become the Terminator. And then after that isn't quite resolved, then it becomes another thing, you know? And so it's constantly kind of shifting goals.
Yeah.
It doesn't just have this one linear goal that, like, this is a movie to end Cyberdyne.
And that makes it from, sort of re-energizes it.
It re-energizes it because it goes from Run.
Mm-hmm.
To Dyson,
yep.
To kill the beast, which is T-1, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
survive.
It was so funny that
survive,
like,
the beast.
After every new goal, the next goal becomes escape the T-1000.
Yeah.
It's like over and over again.
Well, he's the
here,
ticking clock.
We're gonna do this now.
He's
escape
the ticking clock. ticking clock.
There's lots.
I didn't do those, but he's the ultimate one. He's always there.
He's coming.
Mm-hmm. He's coming.
He's coming.
And he ain't stopping.
And this,
he's
this
the it follows.
This collision is happening.
Right.
It's just, when are we going to get to the ultimate end of that?
The second you slow down, he catches up.
He's kind of the tension sauce that you sprinkle on the entire thing.
Right, right.
Oh, man, he's so
like
good.
You could maybe make this movie even without him a little bit.
A lot of it.
You could.
Yeah.
You could.
Sure.
You
could.
I mean, maybe the Sarah Connor Chronicles was sort of that.
Yeah, and I've
sort of
never seen
never
it.
Never watched it.
I mean, not totally, but it kind of.
I've heard,
you know,
praise of it. People
it,
love
it. Was,
yeah, people
it
like
was
it.
Decent.
Yeah.
Yo, you watched it?
Yeah. I watched like, I can't remember how many seasons there were, but I at least watched a season.
I think at that point I was like, this is all too messy for me.
Yeah.
It's too messy. Yeah. I don't like
some
how
ways
messy
I,
this is.
Well, not to get into that, but I probably like the television show more than the movies that followed.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to not talk about the other movies.
Still not big praise, though, but go ahead.
I wanted to add, well, I did, I don't think I wrote this on the thing, but I wanted to talk about a couple of the escalation, because I think this is a masterclass in escalation, and we haven't talked about escalation.
What do you mean by escalation specifically?
Escalation, I think what you mean, I'm putting words in your mouth a little bit, but do you mean like each sequence gets even bigger and tenser, and
there
somehow
is
than
there's
the
that, and then there's sort of a creative way to express that,
okay,
which is sort of taking one idea and like doing it to its extreme,
right? Right.
And
right.
This movie has like an amazing like examples of those. To give you an example, a lot of the scripts that I read, they will sort of have the cool stuff happen up front.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest things, and then the movie will have nothing else like that.
That's
and
not how you have sex, people.
And it's sort right? of like you need this constant escalating drama unfolding that gets bigger and bigger to the end, or else it doesn't give you an emotionally satisfying experience.
Right.
Like, for instance, I use and my client gave me permission to talk about this, and I used this in a past episode. I had a buddy, I consulted on a buddy comedy that was in like wartime setting. And they're in like the desert, like the Middle East. And we get to the desert and they lock into the overall story problem. Mm-hmm. And we haven't seen them training yet. And they immediately get thrown on this mission, this like dramatic mission in the desert that's got bombs exploding and escapes and daring rescues and all these things. And then the next 40 minutes is them training.
Huh?
Like in right. in the thing, and so it's like that's like a great example of the wrong way to track the escalation of your story. But
does it end with them falling asleep?
No, it gets the third act is the third act is big again. Oh, it's okay, in a wartime good. Setting.
Is
so
this Saving Private Ryan?
No,
I don't want to make light of a.
No, it's fine.
Okay, the motorcycle stunts. The Terminator jumps off the canal,
mm-hmm.
and then in the third act. The T-1000 drives out of a high rise into a helicopter, so it's like that set piece, bam, doubled to its extreme. The premise folding in on itself, they have to break Sarah out of the hospital, and then they have to break in to Cyberdyne. The impersonations, the first person that the T-1000 impersonates is John's foster mom. The last person he impersonates is his real mom. The truck chases, the first one is an 18-wheeler versus John on that little puddle jumper scooter, and then the last chase is the liquid nitrogen tanker versus a little slow pickup truck.
Right, right.
So it's the same joke, just mm-hmm. big. And then, like, the best one is the truck crash. Like, the first one, he comes out of fire.
Right.
And the second one, he comes out of ice. It's like a perfect escalation of that. So that was just one thing I noticed that I hadn't really thought mm-hmm. about.
No,
like,
that's
it's
great.
A great,
no, that's
great
amazing.
Construction.
Also, I mean, maybe one of the greatest action directors of all right. time. So he knows escalation.
He knows
right?
how to do it. And also, that's whiteboarding again. Mm-hmm. That's like another example. Yeah. You're like, how can I take this one idea and like push it to its extreme, you know?
Because if you're going to do something again that the audience has seen,
right?
Do it bigger. Or so different.
And I also think right? there's sort of a sense of humor there. Like, we know. Like, right. you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. we're like, I remember when it was just a guy on a scooter.
I think watching this now, there is a slight tongue-in-cheek aspect to
it's,
it.
It's for sure.
It's a lot more humorous than I remember.
Right, right. Yeah. That's kind of part of its charm and its triumph, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you watch the extended cut. With like, you know, the scenes with Arnold learning to smile, like he actually learns to smile, that scene.
Yeah.
Because that's not in the theatrical.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's
super creepy. That's
the
super creepy
smile.
Right. Yeah. Is there anything else we got on here?
I just wanted to tell people to read that. If you want to dig deeper, that Terminator 2, the book of the film.
Yeah.
It sort of goes through, it has the script inside, and then it's got notes from people involved in the filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And it sort of tells you how the script progressed. So, like, for instance, the first draft, John Connor was the narrator. And sort of that, like, reframed the whole movie. And they were like, nah, we can't have James. That's a big change. You know, and there's little things. It's a great screenwriting instruction book because you see all the decision making. It's like, it's a great example of, like, rewriting
mm-hmm.
and, like, how the movie can get better and better of a rewriting. And then I was telling them off the pod when we weren't recording, there's all these scenes they shot there. What did you call them, Bob?
On Bonus Disc, on Thundergrunt. We often call them either walk time or travel time.
Okay.
Which is
explain.
Me and Matt, the host of that, I've always said it's a signifier of a truly bad movie when you're watching characters travel. And bad movies have that all the time. It's, you know, it might be a woman just walking down the street for a minute and a half, which feels excruciating in the runtime of a movie. Sometimes it's just a truck drives down the road for 5 minutes. And that does exist. Movies, the really bad movies do that. Usually it's the bad runtime. But sometimes it's because of just complete incompetence.
Shot it and they were like, this needs to be there. Well, obviously. They need to know they're driving.
Yeah, you can't just cut to a new location. The audience needs to see them get there. But if you have nothing happening.
Right. So this. Really?
And is this movie you're talking about, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? No.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like I could look at it like that.
At least they had good music.
Right.
I didn't see it.
No, yeah. I think there's actually a purpose to that driving scene.
I'm just teasing.
Yeah, okay.
So the book has, these are not just scenes that were in the script. These are scenes that they shot. I was flipping through. There were like a dozen scenes that they shot where it's like, they literally say, we shot this scene where Arnold and John and Sarah were getting out of the car and walking into the Cyberdyne building and then walking from the elevator over to his Miles Dyson's office. And we just thought that was like, we didn't need that. But it's like, you shot it.
Was it second unit, though?
I have no
idea.
Sure,
it wasn't something where like James Cameron, being the insane person he is, was like, I'm keeping my troops busy.
Maybe.
It could have been something like
maybe,
that.
Maybe, but
probably.
But it's like, like for instance, like an example was originally in the bar, there was a scene where Arnold is walking out of the bathroom with the clothes on that he took from the biker, and he's like sort of adjusting the jacket, and he just walks to the door, and then he walks outside. But it's like, that was probably like a day of shooting. Like, and that's like, what does that do? It does nothing.
Right.
And there were like at least a dozen scenes in that book, and it was showing you how like even the masters, you know, they had the travel time in their script.
Well, part of filmmaking is editing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, it's one of those things, like when I direct something, sometimes I wish, like, it's not in the screenplay because I'm writing super tight.
Yeah.
And then I wish I had just walked the person into the room and shot it because it would have taken me. Now, these are different. The ones you're saying are actually different days and different setups.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'm like, damn, why didn't I just make him walk into the room and turn? It would have fixed some stupid thing that I didn't think of that I would just wish I had that extra. So
that's,
maybe
coverage can be nice.
Maybe James Cameron is just, he's got tons of money and he's like, I can do it. Yeah. So I'm just going to film. You know what? Maybe he's got some weird philosophy.
Maybe
like,
something interesting will happen.
I'm just going to film all that stuff just in case.
Yeah.
And odds are I won't need it.
Maybe so.
Yeah.
Still, like, I put my money on keep the troops busy.
Yeah.
I feel like James Cameron's the kind of guy who would be like, we want to keep everyone motivated. Keep them shooting, no matter what. You know what I
mean?
Even
though we're not going to use it. But it's just Arnold walking out of the bathroom.
But he's like,
to the
he has to go figure out something else. And he's like, you got 4 hours of filming doing this. And
no, Arnold.
Yeah.
That's a good theory.
I just like kind of can see James Cameron being that kind of guy.
I like it.
Yeah, yeah.
I like it.
It's the only weird part is the fact that Arnold had to do it. Like that's the part that's scary.
Yeah.
You know, it's one
not
thing.
Not a stand-in.
If it was a stand-in doing it, that'd be one
it's
thing.
It's him doing it.
Why do I have to do this?
I walk.
Right.
Well, on our rewatch, guys, what did you guys learn?
Well, what I learned is not really about the rewatch, is that you told me that the T-1000 was originally conceived for the first movie. That is so informative of this.
It's the India. It's the Temple of Doom minecart race.
Yeah,
yeah, chase.
It's like one whole movie.
Yeah.
One of the things I've always taken from T2 is that T1 is this low budget slasher movie, for better or worse.
Yeah,
this movie's kind of the same movie, but it's like this epic, you know, unforgettable theme. You know, and I know some people like Terminator 1 more than Terminator 2 for different reasons.
They're such different movies.
I mean, they're apples and oranges to me.
There's different reasons.
Well, we've talked about
what
makes a great sequel is being so different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that it's amazing to me that you know, if you would have given me the job to take Terminator 1 and then turn it into like this epic it was the first movie that cost over $100 million.
Wow.
I might have been like, I don't know. Does it justify that?
Yeah.
But it kind of takes this brilliance of James Cameron. But it also shows, in reverse engineering, the one thing that's always so impressive about Terminator is it does something I think all screenwriters can learn from. Big world, small window.
Yeah.
And if you can have this huge world and just have this little peak. So I always say, like, you know, what's my dinner with Andre in the Star Wars universe or something? If you could figure that out, you might have something special you can make that shows that you have this bigger picture thinking. So it's kind of a reverse
big world, small window.
Big world, small window. I always say, look for this big world, huge worlds that you can make on $1 million budget or something. Oh, or,
yeah.
$30,000 budget.
Yeah, you got to make your movie where the characters are sitting in a room and they keep talking about the awesome shit happening outside.
That's right. That's right.
And that we're really interested in the awesome shit outside.
The off-screen movie in this.
The off-screen
insane.
Movie is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, we get a little on-screen.
Yeah.
I think the beginning's on-screen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like he gives us a taste.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I was always kind of surprised with the Terminator thing that we never really got the real. Were the machines
right?
Kind of
Salvation was supposed
I
to be that.
Didn't see it. Yeah,
and
that's what I thought it was going to be, but it wasn't. It's just kind of surprising because it seems like the one place they haven't gone. But
yeah,
it seems kind of obvious. Like,
but you know what? In the end, though, I don't know if I'd even want it. If
I agree,
right.
I agree at this point.
Yeah,
but it's the one different thing. Like they keep kind of remaking the same.
That's the big window.
The big
that's
window.
The big one. That's,
yeah.
That's when, hey, we're a franchise.
Give us the war movie of Terminator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably
yeah.
If I did a television show, maybe that would be the thing.
Yeah. There it is. Your Walking Dead.
Kind of
that's
walking
your Walking
Dead
was, take on.
I didn't watch the Sarah Connor Chronicles. Was that a small window too?
It was a small window.
Okay. I didn't watch it. So
it was a small window.
That took place in its own time.
That's right.
When it aired, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, it wasn't taking place in the future.
No, it was more things coming back to, you know.
Just keep sending
same
everything
thing.
Back.
Yeah.
Just keep sending it back, right?
Yeah.
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 You know, and what I learned is, and we didn't even talk about it, but is that when a movie's this good, is that you don't, all the logical fallacies and problems with, like, if you actually put the logic under a microscope, it falls apart so quick, just like Terminator.
Right. Yeah.
You can't send your father back. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. That's
like,
a really bad idea.
It's a terrible idea. And that all just wipes away with quality and craftsmanship.
Craft. Yeah.
It seriously does, because there's so much about this I would question if not for the movie being incredible.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, under a microscope, it just falls apart. Yeah. But who cares? It's so good.
I think this one's even trickier because it's bigger and she's affecting like the end of Cyberdyne and fixing the Armageddon.
Right.
Whereas the first one, you kind of punt those. We're not going to get into details. We just got to survive. You understand. But this one kind of at least, Terminator 2 at least has somewhat of a bigger window. You know, it's opening the window a little bit more. You could question it.
You know what question I always ask, though? I'm always like, if the humans sent back the reprogrammed T-800, how did they know who did that first from the future, and how did they find out that the exact time that they were doing it?
Right.
It's almost a why now question. You know what I'm saying? But it's a mystery. We don't know how that happened. It doesn't matter.
I always expected that War Against the Machines movie to show that scene.
I think Genesis was
about that. Does it?
I can't fucking remember, to be honest.
Honestly, once after T3, I kind of checked out.
Me too.
Like, T3 I thought was enjoyable.
Me too.
T3 is, in my opinion, the best sequel. I have not seen Dark Fate.
And then the rest of them.
I haven't seen. Have you seen Dark Fate, Jamie?
I have not.
Nobody here has seen Dark Fate.
We chose this because Dark Fate happened.
And honestly, but just because of the Linda Hamilton factor, I do want to see it.
I will see
it. Oh,
absolutely. Sarah Connor.
According to James Cameron, that is the actual T3.
Okay.
Remember that, because like all the rest didn't happen. Now,
okay, they wipe it clean.
They wipe it clean. It's the Halloween 2018 retcon.
Oh,
so Dark Fate is.
I was not aware of that.
They actually, I think Salvation is actually it actually did away with T3. So the technically Dark Fate is the third T3, which is a mess beyond messes. Whatever, it doesn't matter. T2 is one of the greatest endings of all time.
It's all you need.
It does. It's really all you need. But I want to see Dark Fate.
Me too.
Yeah. All right. I think that's it, guys.
Yeah,
that's
man.
All we have to say about the fucking man.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah. Thank you.
You have just listened to Writers Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.